by the Watergate Committee and the federal grand jury. We learned tonight that Senator Stennis will have, according to Howard Baker, the ability to have scientists examine those tapes if he feels they've been doctored. In my career as a correspondent, I never thought I'd be announcing these things. My thanks to my colleagues for this program. I'm John Chancellor, NBC News in New York.
This has been a special report from NBC News and has come to you from Washington.
All of my friends in the Department of Justice, ladies and gentlemen of the press, there can be no greater privilege and there is no greater satisfaction than the opportunity to serve one's country. I shall always be grateful to President Nixon for giving me that opportunity in several demanding positions. Although I strongly believe in the general purposes and priorities of his administration, I have been compelled to conclude that I could better serve my country by resigning my public office than by continuing in it. This is true for two reasons. First, because to continue would have forced me to refuse to carry out a direct order of the President. Second, because I did not agree with the decisions which brought about the necessity for the issuance of that order. In order to make clear how this dilemma came about, I wish to set forth as plainly as I can the facts of the unfolding drama which came to a climax last Saturday evening. To begin, I shall go back to Monday of last week. Two courts, the District Court and the Court of Appeals of the District of Columbia, had ruled that the privilege protecting presidential communications must give way to the criminal process, but only to the extent that a compelling necessity had been shown. The President had a right of further review in the Supreme Court of the United States. He had a right, in other words, to try to persuade the Supreme Court that the long-term public interest in maintaining the confidentiality of presidential communications is more important than the public interest in the prosecution of a particular criminal case, especially where other evidence is available. Had he insisted on exercising that right, however, the issue would have been subject to continuing litigation and controversy for a prolonged additional period, and this at a time of acute international crisis. Against this background, the President decided on Monday afternoon to make a new effort to resolve the impasse. He would ask Senator John Stennis, a man of impeccable reputation for truthfulness and integrity, to listen to the tapes and verify the completeness and accuracy of a record of all pertinent portions. This record would then be available to the grand jury and for any other purpose for which it was needed. Believing, however, that only the issue of his own involvement justified any breach of the principle of confidentiality, and wishing to avoid continuing litigation, he made it a condition of the offer to provide a verified record of the subpoenaed tapes, that access to any other tapes or records would be barred. I regarded the proposal to rely on Senator Stennis for a verified record, for the sake of brevity, I will call it the Stennis proposal, as reasonable, but I did not think it should be tied to the foreclosure of the right of the special prosecutor to invoke judicial process in future situations. Accordingly, I outlined the Stennis proposal to Mr. Cox later on Monday afternoon and proposed that the question of other tapes and documents be deferred. Mr. Cox and I discussed the Stennis proposal again on Tuesday morning. On Wednesday afternoon, responding to Mr. Cox's suggestion that he could deal more concretely with the proposal if he had it on paper, I sent him the document captioned "A Proposal," which he released at his Saturday press conference. On the afternoon of the next day, he sent me his comments on the proposal, including the requirement that he have assured access to other tapes and documents. The president's lawyers regarded Mr. Cox's comments as amounting to a rejection of the Stennis proposal, and there followed the break-off of negotiations, reflected in the correspondence with Charles Allen Wright, released by Mr. Cox. My position at that time was that Senator Stennis's verified record of the tapes should nevertheless be presented to the district court for the court's determination of its adequacy to satisfy the subpoenas, still leaving other questions to be dealt with as they arose. That was still my view when, at 8 p.m. Friday evening, the president issued his statement directing Mr. Cox to make no further attempts by judicial process to obtain tapes, notes, or memoranda of presidential conversation. A half hour before this statement was issued, I received a letter from the president instructing me to give Mr. Cox this order. I did not act on the instruction, but instead, shortly after noon on Saturday, sent the president a letter restating my position. You have, I believe, copies both of the president's letter and of my reply. The president, however, decided to hold fast to the position he had announced the night before. When, therefore, Mr. Cox rejected that position and gave his objections to the Stennis proposal, as well as his reasons for insisting on assured access to other tapes and memoranda, the issue of presidential authority versus the independence and public accountability of the special prosecutor was squarely joined. The president, at that point, thought he had no choice but to direct the Attorney General to discharge Mr. Cox. And I, given my role in guaranteeing the independence of the special prosecutor, as well as my belief in the public interest embodied in that role, felt equally clear that I could not discharge him. And so I resigned. At stake in the final analysis is the very integrity of the governmental processes I came to the Department of Justice to help restore. My own single most important commitment to this objective was my commitment to the independence of the special prosecutor. I could not be faithful to this commitment and also acquiesce in the curtailment of his authority. To say this, however, is not to charge the president with a failure to respect the claims of the investigative process. Given the importance he attached to the principle of presidential confidentiality, he believed that his willingness to allow Senator Stennis to verify the subpoenaed tapes fully met these claims. The rest is for the American people to judge. On the fairness with which you do so, may well rest the future well-being and security of our beloved country. And now, in conclusion, I would like to say just a word of thanks and respect to my former colleagues in the Department of Justice. This is a great department devoted to great ends. You have served it, I know, and I know you will continue to serve it with integrity, with loyalty, and with high professional competence. It has been one of the great joys of my life, even though briefly, to have served with you and to have known you. And I hope that, at least for many of you, there will be an opportunity for us to get together again from time to time. Mr. Stewart has the first question.
Mr. Attorney General, your statement suggests that it was rather late in the drama that the president concluded he would have to fire Mr. Cox. What do you say to those who take a different view, who say that there was a long campaign to get rid of Mr. Cox? And specifically, what do you say to those who suggest that attempts were directly or indirectly made to use you as an agent to that end?
I would say to that that the firing of Mr. Cox came as the kind of climax to the sequence I've described. I'm not in a position, of course, to know what the motives of others were. I can only say that the initial suggestion of a move toward firing Cox came in the context of an effort to break the constitutional impasse. And of course, one way to do that would, by firing Mr. Cox, have been to make the constitutional issues moot.
Mr. Attorney General, did you conclude and or suspect, as reported this morning, that there were attempts by the president or presidential aides to limit the Cox investigation through you?
No. There were, of course, continuing concerns on the part of President's counsel, particularly with respect to issues of jurisdiction. And although I had started out right after my confirmation with a totally hands-off position, one essentially of no communication either with Mr. Cox or with counsel for the president, the role I'd had in the drafting of his charter made it appropriate for me, I thought, to try to serve as a means of reconciling differences over the question of what fell within Mr. Cox's jurisdiction. This was a continuing problem, and it was the subject of a good deal of communication. But there was a recognition always that wherever a lead pointing toward possible criminal conduct existed, it would be somebody's responsibility to pursue that lead. And if it were not Mr. Cox's, then, of course, it would have been the responsibility of the criminal division. It's litigious.
Richardson, are we not back to square one in which an administration is in the position of investigating itself, and is that a credible position?
I can only say to that, first of all, that I do believe and that the role of a special prosecutor with the independence that was given to Mr. Cox is an important guarantee of the integrity of any investigation. And as you remember, I had announced even before my own confirmation hearing began that I would, if confirmed, appoint a special prosecutor. At the same time, however, I think it's important also to reaffirm my own confidence in the complete integrity of Henry Peterson. And I know that whatever he does and whatever is done under his direction and supervision will be done right.
Yes. Sir, you've made it clear that you did not agree with the so-called compromise proposal of the White House, at least to the extent that you didn't feel the prosecutor should give up his right to pursue in the judicial process other tapes and memoranda. Do you still feel that way, and do you think that the Watergate prosecution should go ahead in court?
Yes, I think that the next step should be a judicial determination of the acceptability of the what I referred to in my proposal as the verified record, that is a transcript put into the third person with eliminations only of things having nothing to do with Watergate and with paraphrases only where the language used in the course of conversation would in itself have been embarrassing or where there were references to matters of potential genuine harm to the national security if released. Mr. Mollenhoff.
Do you have any conversations with President Nixon relative to the importance of the independence of a special prosecutor, either prior to your hiring or afterwards?
I had only one conversation with Mr. Nixon directly about the role of a special prosecutor, and that was at the time when he initially asked me if I would be willing to be nominated as Attorney General. And at that time, he said, in effect, what he said the next day in a public statement, that he would commit to my determination to question whether or not a special prosecutor would be needed. He also affirmed at that time the determination that whoever was responsible for the investigation would pursue it fully, fearlessly, wherever it might lead.
Do you feel that he reneged on that particular promise to you?
As he said in his own public statement, and as he said in his letter to me, which you now have, he had conceitedly intruded upon the degree of independence that had originally been attached to the role of the Attorney General and the Special Prosecutor.
Did he say it was the intrusion? Was there any specific thing that Mr. Cox did? Any specific evidence that he wanted? For example, the Bebe Rabosa material that you had an indication was over the line as far as the President was concerned?
No, there was no such specific thing. There were, as I said, continuing arguments over the issue of jurisdiction and access to particular notes, memoranda, documents, and so on. And these were the subject of considerable conversation between Mr. Cox and Mr. Bizarre, as Mr. Cox said on Saturday. Yes.
General, in the matter of those documents, the agreement seems to cover only the tapes. Special Prosecutor and the Watergate Committee are after further documents. Do you think that they will now be denied access to them under this agreement as it's operative in the eyes of the White House?
Of course, the question now is how the issue is going to be raised and by whom. My assumption is that in one way or another, through the judicial process, the issue will get raised. And, of course, the question of what is required for the integrity of these investigations and prosecutions is now, at least for the time being, a matter resting under the jurisdiction of the Acting Attorney General and Mr. Peterson.
Barbara. Mr. Richardson, there have been reports that the President would like to find still another role for you in his administration. Have you had any such offers, and what would be your reaction to them?
No, I haven't had any such offers. I can only say that as to my future, I look forward to a considerable period to think back over a lot of things, perhaps to get some reflections on paper. This is, after all, the first time I've been out of a job since Bobby Kennedy fired me.
Write a book.
When Mr. Nixon issued the order for you to fire Mr. Cox, was he aware that that would force you to resign, or was the President surprised?
The question of what I would do was, I think, unclear from his perspective up to the point on Saturday afternoon when I came to see him. There had been issues drawn earlier in the week in which I had made clear that if certain action were taken, I would be forced to resign. The question, of course, was finally precipitated by the direction to fire him, or by the understanding that I would be so directed. And that, of course, did not come until after Mr. Cox's press conference.
Mr. Richardson?
Mr. Richardson, excuse me. Did you, at any time during the course of these discussions as to Mr. Cox's, the extent of his authority, did you at any time divert him or try to divert him from any phase of the investigation that he was conducting?
No, although I did participate in discussions of jurisdictional issues with him along the lines that I have touched on earlier. But there was certainly never any question of heading off an investigation.
Mr. Richardson,
as I say, was one of whose job it would be. Yes.
Mr. Richardson, when you were first confirmed as Attorney General,
You said your chief aim was to restore public confidence in the Justice Department and government. How do you believe the developments of the past weekend, in particular the president's open defiance of the courts, will affect public confidence in government?
I think that we need to let some time pass and developments unfold before we try to render a verdict. The president has not yet defied any court order. And I trust that a situation in which he is placed in that position never arises. Indeed, I have no reason to believe that he would defy court order. Yes.
Mr. Richardson, do you believe the president should be impeached?
The question of any ultimate judgment to be made on these facts is, in my view, a question for the American people. I have been part of Mr. Nixon's administration from the beginning. As I've said, I believe in the objectives and priorities of the administration. I regard particularly as important the role of the President of the United States, President Richard Nixon, in dealing with international problems. We've had a very recent illustration of the skill and the firmness with which he has dealt with that kind of crisis. And so I do not believe that I am the person, based on the record of these events, who should try to pass judgment on them. Lewis.
You said that the president is not in defiance of any court order as yet, which is technically correct. Would you think that it was a good lesson for the American people, for a party to a lawsuit, to allow an order of a court to become final, and then unilaterally to announce a, quote, settlement, unquote, and then to negotiate with the lower courts about whether that is compliant?
Well, I think that the question of taking this in steps, deciding not to challenge a court order, and then proposing a way of dealing with it, is, it seems to me, a perfectly legitimate approach. The real question is, what happens then, once the proposal for dealing with it as a means of compliance or intended compliance is then dealt with? And we, I think, are not going to be in a situation where defiance of an order is an issue until after the court has passed on the acceptability of the proposal. Yes.
Do you have an opinion as to the adequacy of the Stennis document, whatever that becomes, for criminal prosecutorial purposes at a trial? And if you have an opinion, what is it?
Well, I think it needs to be emphasized that the question in the first instance is one for a judge to determine in the light of the way in which the record was prepared and all the other circumstances surrounding it. It seemed to me that at least for grand jury purposes, the verified record prepared by Senator Stennis ought to serve. Next question then is, may it be used in evidence as an alternative to the original tapes or to a verbatim transcript of the tapes? My thought there was that this question should also be presented to the court in the first instance. If the court would rule on it, well and good. If not, then it would have to be dealt with at the next stage. Didn't I express that an opinion? You want to restate the question?
No, as to whether that was adequate.
I told you my view, and it is spelled out in the letter which you have, which is, as a matter of fact, Mr. Cox, in his comments on the proposal, remarked that this was among, he thought, its good features, namely an approach to the court which would seek to persuade the court that it would serve.
General, how would you have acted if you were in Cox's shoes then? Would you have done the same thing he would have done or something different?
I would have done what he has done.
Mr. Peterson's integrity, do you think it's at all possible that he or anybody within the Justice Department can now carry on a fully independent investigation of Watergate, or do you think maybe it should be done by Congress?
I think the situation is fraught with great difficulty for him, and I think that whoever is Attorney General and Mr. Peterson would both be in a better position if a new special prosecutor were appointed.
Mr. Richardson,
you leave me one possible interpretation of your remarks, the tone of them, and your warm attitude towards the President and the White House, is that you were placed temporarily in a tactically untenable position, perhaps on a minor matter in the larger scheme of things, the administration's record and so forth. Is this a correct interpretation of what you're trying to say?
Well, of course, you are speaking in judgmental terms. I've tried to set out as clearly as I can what my role was, what my position is, the reasons why I believe that I should resign. I was a participant in the creation of the role of special prosecutor. I believe that a special prosecutor was necessary and that he had to act in a position of full authority and complete independence. This, of course, was a central subject of the hearings on my own confirmation. I believe that the pursuit of the investigations that were being conducted by Mr. Cox should be continued to be pursued by someone who was eventually in the same kind of position of independence.
Along that line, there's a problem of the administration investigating itself. Would a special prosecutor be better in the Congress or under the aegis of the court or something like that, rather than in the executive court?
I think that the charter that was established for Mr. Cox did give him, and I think his conduct of his office establishes that it is possible for a special prosecutor with that kind of charter to act with full independence and total integrity, and I think the manner in which he has acted proves this. Yes.
Mr. Cox made clear that as special investigator, he wasn't getting access to any of the White House information. He couldn't even get an inventory of White House documents. And he raised the possibility that this would hinder or even block prosecution of Mr. Haldeman, Mr. Ehrlichman, all those former White House people. And of course, you specifically objected in the president's compromise to the order to Cox to cease seeking these documents. Do you think the president is trying to protect these former top White House officials?
Let me deal first with the point you made about refusal of papers. Actually, of course, a great many papers were turned over to Mr. Cox, including by the White House, including all the ICC papers, for example. And there was still, under negotiation, access to the papers that had not yet been turned over at the time he was discharged. I don't think that the failures to turn over papers in any given case can be attributed to any new cover-up of anybody in the White House. Mr. Leiter.
In your conversations with the president, did you ever say, as you said today, that the question really was the very integrity of the governmental processes that you came to restore? Further, did you presume to advise him on the political consequences, including perhaps impeachment? And finally, if you felt so strongly about it, I'm not really clear why you didn't refuse the order and ask to be fired, in effect, but rather, in effect, sidestep the crisis and resign in advance.
Well, I'm not sure what the implications of moving one way or the other were. It seemed to me that a crisis had been reached, at least so far as my own situation was concerned. Now,
why not refuse the order and take the consequences?
Well, I suppose I might have done it that way. The way I did do it was to ask to see the president in order to inform him that I would resign as soon as I heard that he intended to issue such an order.
Back to my original question, did you say, Mr. President, what's at stake here?